This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time once again to find out about Veterans Affairs Matters, Indiana and elsewhere. We have in the studio with us Tom Pappas, who is a member of the City of Portage Veterans Committee. We've had him in to talk about veterans issues before, and he's back with some new ones and an important trip that he and his colleagues are going to be making to Indianapolis to talk with the Indiana Veterans Affairs people about matters. Tom, thanks for being with us again today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have another committee meeting tonight. Let's talk about that first.
Well, we have a very renowned presenter, Dr. Munt. He's a clinical psychologist. Does a lot of work with Jesse Brown, so I hope some of you listening right now will show up tonight and ask him questions and educate yourself on PTSD. And we meet at 5 o'clock at Woodland Park, 2100 Willow Creek Road in Portage.
Now, we've talked about the subject of PTSD in recent months. We've talked mainly in the context of recent veterans, those who've been involved in the Gulf Wars, but you can even go back as far back as World War II, can't you? Just wasn't known as that. It was known as shell shock back then.
Shell shock, yes.
And are we still finding World War II veterans that have problems?
Well, almost there aren't too many of them left.
That's true too. You know,
but yes, there are still some out there that are have problems, and that primarily manifests itself as being homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a percentage of them still floating around homeless.
I was going to ask if that was the case because you don't see them on the streets very much, at least not often. But I'm sure that they probably are making the rounds of the missions and the homeless shelters that are out there. They probably do make if they're not being taken care of by the communities who are helping homeless veterans in particular. They're still probably floating around out there now.
I haven't seen any statistics. I don't even know if there are any out there about how many homeless World War II vets exist. I would hope that they're by now at their ages in some of the veterans' homes and being mm-hmm. taken care of there. Mm-hmm. That's my sincere hope, but I don't know if that's the case.
Sure. You mentioned about Dr. Munt being a specialist in these matters. Tell us what he's told you about some of the things that he has done research on or that he has to work with veterans every day about it.
Well, he's out of Jesse Brown. Right. He does long-term case management for veterans. I'm reading his biography mm-hmm. that he sent me. His focus is on stabilization and brief treatment of traumatic reactions stemming from combat, sexual assault, which is a big issue in today's military. I know two women that that were victims of military sexual trauma, mm-hmm. and it's really hard on the ladies because the services have historically tried to cover that up. They don't want people to know that they have internal problems. He's presenting tonight not from the perspective of the VA, just to share his experiences and his knowledge. But I have no doubt there's going to be questions about the VA and mm-hmm. some of the veterans' experience with the VA.
Well, certainly if they know and they learn at the meeting that his connection with the Jesse Brown facility in Chicago that he's going to have some connection with the VA medical healthcare system. I'm sure they'll have questions.
I hope so. It's somewhat frustrating. There's so many veterans, but so few really take advantage of what we're offering in Portage, mm-hmm. and that primarily is education. Though we are now on Friday, we're going to do some advocacy.
Oh.
And that's part of our mission.
That's great. Tell about how that got started and when it happened.
In December, we had the Indiana Department of Veterans Affairs mm-hmm. present. They drove two of their specialists drove in from Indianapolis, and they really enlightened everybody. There were programs out there I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
But the one issue that was kind of contentious was how the Military Family Relief Fund is being handled. At that time, there was a 45-day backlog. And what many veterans don't know is you may be eligible for a one-time grant from the Military Family Relief Fund of $2,500. And there's some criteria you have to meet, but most generally a veteran will meet the criteria. And if you're in financial difficulty, I've spoken to veterans that were going to lose their homes. They went and got their grant, their $2,500 grant, tided them over until they could get back on their feet, and they didn't lose their homes. It's a good deal. But what concerned us, and one of my committee members put in because she had some health issues and had to take time off from work, and she wound up 2 months behind on her rent because of this backlog and how the IDVA is not efficiently issuing these grants. 45 days is too long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if it's someone in serious need, like you say, like yes. In this particular case, for anybody for that matter.
Too. Yes.
If you're in desperate need of the funds, you want to have the funds right away. You want them yesterday, actually.
Actually, yes, yeah, you're right, that's Chris. That's but that's yeah. not happening. And we discussed it at our meeting in December, and the committee got together, and we've taken a position, and two of us are going down to Indy Friday to present and advocate for veterans up here in Northwest Indiana.
Now, you have a copy, and I have a copy of the letter that the committee is sending down to the Indiana Department of Veterans Affairs, and you're going to take down with you, I take
yes.
it, to a trip to Indianapolis. Tell us yes. about what the letter does mention about the fact that they had this discussion at the December meeting, but tell us in more detail what you're hoping that through this letter that the committee hopes that the IDVA will do.
IDVA has done an excellent job in training county service officers. And they've advocated that every county have a certified, accredited service officer. And they've done a good job in providing that training. All we're suggesting is for the IDVA to take that task upon themselves and certify or accreditize individuals to submit these Military Family Relief Fund claims. And we're advocating that if they're trained and accredited, that those claims should go right to the head of the line. And why are we advocating that? One, the bog down in India is that they're having to vest all these veterans. They're having to check out their claims and that. That could be done on a local level if you have trained individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that claim hits Indianapolis, bam, it's ready. Just, you know, review it. If you got to do a little vesting, it shouldn't take a couple hours to vest, send the check to the veteran.
Is it your impression that that the IDVA, even though they have supported the training for these veteran service officers, that they don't necessarily trust them, or maybe they don't think they have the right kind of training to be able to do this preparation work?
Oh, the training is different for this than it is for to be a service officer.
Oh.
Okay.
So maybe they don't have the training to begin with, I guess. Or some
no,
maybe not.
The service officers really don't have the training.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to guess that they just didn't think to do this. Somehow they got stuck on a road that they were happy going down, and they weren't looking to get onto the expressway. If I may.
Well, that's a good way to put it. I-65 certainly is a good
yeah,
thing.
They
for
were
at least
stuck
our
on
link
Route
is,
20
right.
and they didn't get out on the expressway.
Yeah, if they may make that trip from Indianapolis to Northwest Indiana in particular. In having this conversation this week with the folks at the IDVA, what are you hoping that they can do, that they'll just this may start the conversation or
oh,
we'll get them
yeah,
prompted?
Yeah, I don't see any quick results from this. If they have to do training, if we can get them to do training, they're going to have to develop the training program. Shouldn't take a couple days, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll have to schedule it and they'll have to put out notice. I would hope maybe by this summer they would have an expedited process in place. We also are going to advocate while we're down there. Some of the military services are kicking veterans out for not real good reasons. The veterans have problems because of their service or whatever, and they're the branches are kicking them out with bad paper, bad discharges.
Right.
And a lot of them are not warranted. They should have been given help before they were given it, shown the door, if you will. And we're saying that the VA, the IDVA, should have some compassion for these veterans and review what transpired with them being kicked out of the military and make sure that they, if they're eligible, they get something if they need it. If their bad conduct discharges that bad and justified, well, then they're out of luck.
Right. I understand, and I'm not sure if this was the case, but I know for a long time, and maybe it's been changed since I'd heard this, that even if you got a general discharge, you still weren't eligible for all of the benefits that the VA would be able to give you if you had just had an honorable discharge.
Anything other than honorable pretty much precludes any assistance from the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame.
Oh, that might be something that might be our Congressman Pete Fisklosky and his colleagues are going to have to bring up. They're going to have to bring up on a national level if it isn't if it's something that they can do. If it can something they can do at the state level, that would be great. At least they could they could advocate for a bigger change that could come about here too.
I'm going to try to make Pete is having some town hall meetings. I'm going to try to make the one in Portage Saturday, just to see if he's going to support giving veterans their choice of health care between the private sector and the VA.
One of the other things here, and I would come back to a document that I've got here is about my VA.
About
that. But I want to mention, too, about the fact that we know there's a Veterans Day coming up at the State House.
Yes.
And what a perfect time to have a Veterans at the State House when you have the General Assembly in session.
This is I think it's the third one now. I went to one in 16. I missed the one in 15. It's a good thing you got it there in front of you.
Yeah, this is going to be on Monday, January 23rd. It's a program that starts at 9 o'clock in the morning until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It'll be there at the State House. And trust it, it'll be in the rotunda where it's nice and warm.
It's
certainly a lot warmer than it'll be outdoors, to be sure. And it's an event that it says here is sponsored or hosted, rather, by two representatives, Jim Baird and John Bartlett. I'm sure very, very close to everyone who is concerned about Veterans Affairs.
Yes.
They certainly have been supportive of that in their districts. And
very
I'm sure they
supportive.
Would like to make it statewide if they haven't.
And it's an opportunity for veterans to connect with their state rep and their state senator.
That's right. That's
MyVA.
MyVA. This is a document. I think I have seen some of this online, but for people who are not familiar with the opportunity to sign on to myva.gov, this is the way to do it. It gives you a great deal of information if you're a veteran or if you're a family member of a veteran to learn about these benefits
And this is a new program that Secretary McDonald put together. It's an outreach program. We have the woman that is in charge of it for the northern end of the state and into Chicago, Lynette Taylor. She's coming in February 1st to present on this. And I'm encouraging veterans to educate yourself a little bit about this because this could be a big thing for eliminating the communication issues between the VA and the veterans.
That's great. So we have the doctor from the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago coming in this evening to talk about PTSD issues and give his take on these issues as well. And then in February, the Veterans Committee is going to be taking a look here with this representative talking about MyVA.gov.
Yes.
So it'll be very interesting. So a couple good Veterans Committee meetings coming up, sponsored by the City of Portage, the mayor of Portage's Veterans Committee. Tom Pappas is a member of that Veterans Committee from Portage with us to talk about veterans issues, and we thank you very much for taking time to talk.
Thank you, Chris. Welcome home to everybody.
A couple great programs coming up here in the weeks ahead, and thank you for talking about it today. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. An old car wash at 169th Street and Kennedy Avenue in Hammond is one that Mayor Tom McDermott says is referred to as an eyesore, and it's not there anymore. The structure was demolished sometime in the last couple weeks of December, and McDermott told Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson that it's not yet known what is going to go on to the property, but regardless, it's better than just an empty space.
You know, Hammond's real aggressive with our use of demolitions, and we allot $1 million every year and have done so ever since I've been there to tear down structures like this, and in this case, it's been an eyesore for well over the past year. It's been out of operation, and It was purchased by Lukoil, the gentleman that owns Lukoil. It's not going to, and a lot of people thought that meant it was going to be converted into a gas station, which is not the case. It's going to be some type of strip unit, like a strip mall type of unit where, you know, across the street, he also owns a strip mall with Jimmy John's in it. So this lot is challenging, though, because it's basically a triangle. So it's not a full-size lot, which gives it challenges that other lots typically don't have.
Oh, like there's a size restriction or something?
Yeah, because the back end of the lot is right along the railroad tracks, so you can't really extend into the railroad tracks. And then it's surrounded by Kennedy on one side and 169th on the other side. So there's really no way to enlarge the piece of property, and it's like a triangle. Harder. That's why the car wash has always been there, because it's really limited uses. But it's better now than it was, because it was just an eyesore, and we don't like that in Hammond. We try to eliminate the eyesores.
Why was it an eyesore? Was the building just decrepit, fallen down?
It was probably built, I'm going to guess, in the 60s, 70s, and at one time it was pretty heavily used car wash, but over the years, car washes have become automated, and this was a manual car wash, and over the years, fewer and fewer people went there, and then finally they shut down about a year or two ago, and it's literally just sat there decaying for the last couple of years. And it's a prominent intersection, and you have this old decaying car wash. It's better as a flat piece of earth than what it was before. So even if we never developed it, which isn't our plan, but even if we never developed it, I like it better now than I did with the old abandoned car wash there.
You mentioned about the strip mall. Could you tell me about the plans that are going to go, what's going to go there?
No, I don't know much about the plans of what's going to go there. I do know they knocked it down, and I do know that they plan to build some type of strip mall there. It's not going to be even as big as the one on the other side of the street. It's probably like a single use. I think Jimmy John's would have worked perfect on this piece of property. Something like that will have to go there. Something that can stand on its own but doesn't generate too much traffic and doesn't need too much parking. It's a challenging site. It really is. But like I said, it's better as a flat piece of earth as it is right now than it was as an abandoned car wash. So I'm happy. It's definitely a challenging site to develop because of its constraints.
Do you know that little strip mall that's going to go there, when it's going to be done?
No, I don't. But the one across the street, they're filling tenants right now in it. It's completed. Jimmy John's has moved in. I believe they have two more subleases that they need to fill. I imagine once that fills up, they'll be looking to expand across the street, because it's the same owner that owns both sides of the street now.
What's the man's name who bought it?
Tom Collins. He's the CEO of Lukoil. Because Lukoil bought it, a lot of people were saying it was going to be a gas station, and that is absolutely not true. It's not able to be a gas station. It's never been in the plans. So I do want to dispel that rumor that's been out there. Just because Lukoil purchases something doesn't mean it's going to be a gas station. Lukoil is involved in many businesses. So
I see. Why would it have been a bad thing if it was a gas station?
Well, it's not possible, really, because, you know, you need to have underground storage tanks and gas stations, and you need to have a big footprint, you know, because of the traffic the gas stations generate, and it's just not possible on this location.
Well, thanks. Is there anything else that you wanted to add about this that maybe I haven't asked you about?
No. Like I said, we're happy it's down because it was an eyesore, and once it gets built, it'll be even better. But for right now, I think most residents are happy that it's just on the ground, so.
That's Mayor Tom McDermott of Hammond, and talking about the now vacant site at 169th and Kennedy Avenue in the Hessville neighborhood. He was talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Technology and online tools are not only common in today's classroom, they are necessary. One of the most important components of digital learning is high-speed internet. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Clara McInerney reports that many rural school districts hope that the Indiana legislature will increase funding for internet infrastructure.
Let's go back to room 36.
Today is a special day for the high school students in Alyssa Parr's advanced art history class.
I know, there's that horse again. All right, let's rotate around.
This group of students at Milan High School is taking a field trip to the National Gallery in London, looking at neoclassical pieces they've been studying. But the class of 30 didn't travel to England. Instead, students are taking a virtual tour of the museum, navigating through the marble hallways and gold leaf vaulted ceilings on their laptops.
Now, does this piece of artwork, listen up,
Parr says it's a big deal for her students who live in the small southeastern Indiana town.
We live pretty far out in the middle of nowhere, so taking a field trip is an all-day thing, and that's hard to take.
And before today's virtual field trip to the museum, Parr asked the class of 30 how many had been to an art gallery in person. Eight students raised their hands.
No, we weren't there. I was there.
Does this make any of you want to go to London now and go to the actual National Gallery?
Yeah.
It takes a lot of money to ensure 30 kids can do virtual tours on 30 laptops. And Mylan invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in high-speed internet and laptops over the last few years. This kind of investment isn't always an easy choice for small districts, who have been struggling since property tax caps went into place and decreasing enrollment, both of which take a toll on a district's budget.
Basically, you push to the side some things that you maybe want to do as far as resurfacing a parking lot or repairing some doors or windows.
This is Mylan School Superintendent Paul Ketchum.
And you just say that the investment that we're going to make in this project is going to have an exponential effect on students.
Ketchum says investing in high-speed internet not only gives students opportunities in the classroom, it is often the only place they can access the internet and online tools.
There is a digital divide in Ripley County, especially in our homes. A lot of students don't have access to high-speed internet.
Evan Smith is one of those students. He's a senior at Mylan High School, and Wi-Fi at his home is slow and limited. With so much of his homework online, he often works in the middle of the night when the internet is faster and more available.
Because the Wi-Fi is limited data from 5 a.m. until midnight, but then from midnight to 5 a.m. it's unlimited data. It's not limited.
So are you tired some days when you come in just because you were trying to get your homework done?
Yeah, a lot of days.
And some members of the General Assembly have talked about allocating money to help more rural districts do what Mylan schools did, invest in internet infrastructure and devices so students like Smith can explore the world outside their small towns. But this issue will compete for lawmakers' attention in the upcoming legislative session. 200 miles away from Mylan, in Morocco, Indiana.
Had a busy morning?
Oh, yeah.
Superintendent for North Newton Schools, Dustin Haas, hopes lawmakers will see internet infrastructure as a long-term payoff. Morocco is just south of Lake County, and Haas spent a lot of money over the last few years installing towers to increase bandwidth, but it's not enough. He also purchased iPads for every student, but they can't all use them at the same time because the internet bandwidth is just too slow.
Streaming a video or streaming music, and you know, we're in a digital age now where we're using those things, it's almost impossible to do because of that factor right there.
So they often stagger iPad use. And when they do state testing, they ask teachers not administering a test to stay off the internet so it won't crash. Haas would love to see the school connect to the internet with fiber connections that go underground, because in Northwest Indiana, the tower reception is touch and go.
If we have inclement weather, whether it be ice or snow or rain or bad strong winds, it's going to affect our internet connection.
So while legislators will have a lot of requests this budget session, Haas says this should be a priority.
It would just be like them being at the state house and they're not having internet capabilities, or that only half of them can work at a certain time. They're not going to like that.
The legislative session starts January 3rd. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Claire McInerney.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. How did Donald Trump win the presidency when the polls had him losing? Did social media influence the campaigns? Counterpoint host Gerard McClendon says sometimes your instincts fail and you have to rely on hard data. But he asks, what if the data says one thing and the outcome is completely different? Gerard and his guests, Kathleen Murphy with the Illinois Policy Opportunity Project online, Andy Quinnell of the Munster GOP Central Committee, and Matt Reardon of MCR Partners Limited, take up the topic, are political polls obsolete in the social media age? Here's the conversation.
You know, I was coming up with a lot of red references in reference to the bluing and redding of the United States. It looks like Donald Trump has won the presidency, and I'm still kind of trying to figure this thing out. More so than Clinton and Trump, though, let's talk about polls and polling being obsolete. Is it a thing of the past? There were several quote-unquote reputable polling organizations that got it totally wrong. So, you three, I ask you, is polling obsolete? Who wants to start us off here? Yes, Kathleen.
I don't think it's a thing of the past. I think polls can be useful in not just in predicting the outcome of the race, but in determining how effective a messaging campaign is into a district to see if it moves the needle at all after, you know, you sent in mail pieces and ads. I think that in this case, pollsters consistently misidentified the voters that Trump was turning out. And I'm not sure what happened there. I think a lot of them are going to have to look at the methods that they're using and their some of the operations, because their polls were not worth the paper that they were printed on. And I think another thing that happened was there did seem to be this silent majority who maybe didn't even want to tell a pollster how they were going to vote for fear of being stigmatized for whatever reason. So I think for whatever reason, they didn't say one way or another. They got lumped into a group that maybe had voted for, was a likely Clinton voter. But when they went to the voting booth in that privacy, they went Trump.
So, Andy, polls, obsolete, so this is where I'm going with this. And I'm so glad that you teed it off here, Kathleen. When you look at landlines, cell phones, and email. Where's the flaw when it comes to polling in those three forms of media?
Well, first off, it's people, you have to identify the voters. You have to identify likely voters, of course, as well. Then you also have to get them to answer, and you have to get them to give you truthful answers. I think a lot of times when they're calling and polling, they ask you all these questions down the line, what is your views on, on gun control, on economic development, whatever it might be. And then the last question they ask you is, if you were to vote today, would you vote for this candidate or that candidate? However, the answers that maybe they say they're going to vote for candidate A, but the answers they gave to the polling were more in tune with candidate B, and I don't think they really pick up on that. I don't think that, Trump identified a lot of voters, I believe, that were no pollsters were identifying, no pollsters were picking up. And, and I said this last week, his numbers had to be showing, his internals had to be showing something in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and all these other states where he was heading to. Mm-hmm. And I think Clinton's internals showed him the same things because they were chasing after him.
Okay. So this so-called hidden vote, it wasn't seen. And I got to go to you, Matt. Are traditional polls staring down the barrel of obsolescence now?
I think Kathleen hit the nail on the head when she said there's a purpose for this. And I think, and I've seen personally, a lot of it has to do with tracking of information. It's better to track a message and to find out if that message is resonating with people and then you're able to grapple onto an issue. And we sat here 6 months ago, mm-hmm. and I said a couple things. I said, Trump is the music man. He's a salesman. And he is at the cutting edge of using technology, and that would change the way campaigns are done. And I think that was proven in the fact that his outreach goes so far beyond any normal means of door knocking, ground game, mailings, and all of that. So that has an impact on the polls, because traditionally you're taking a representative sample of normal voters. Well, when you don't have normal voters voting, you have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When you don't have normal voters voting, and when you have normal voters not voting. Kathleen, you got a comment.
Or when you're turning out disaffected voters, which they have not pulled a primary ballot. That's how pollsters a lot of times determine whether they're a likely Democrat, likely Republican voter. If they haven't pulled a ballot, you're not even reaching out to them.
Or they haven't even voted in, because they're also looking at likely voters. So maybe they haven't voted in the last two mm-hmm. cycles or three cycles. So now you're sitting here going, okay, we're going to write them off. And those are the ones that actually came out and voted, because they're the disenfranchised.
Yeah. It's funny. Kathleen and I were on an ABC show, and it was interesting. I tried to call it. I called it wrong. And Kathleen, during the show, she was so nice to me. She was so nice. She didn't rub it in. She just said, not so fast, Gerard. And what's interesting about this is, did social media, the internet, apps, the sensationalism of all of this, did that drive the electorate? Here we have a candidate who said, I'm gonna self fund. And within that self-funding, the candidate pretty much gets on CNN every night by sending tweets. Kathleen?
I think it benefited him, his use of Twitter. People are kind of really thirsty for some transparency in government and some accessibility, and that's part of this is part of the contrast between him and Hillary Clinton. People like that openness in his communication style, that he would put something on Twitter, they could respond to it, he could retweet them, which again was him going to the voter and saying, look, I respect you. They ignore you, but I respect you. That reinforced that message from him. I do think he should continue that open style of communication in his presidency, whether it's a town hall forums. I mean, I think maybe somebody should edit his tweets, maybe run it past Melania or somebody before he sends it out.
Do you think he should maybe use email?
I think email. I think a town hall. Yeah. Oh no. A town hall.
His own private server.
Yeah. Put it in the basement.
I'm from Illinois, so I'm like a step behind you guys in Indiana. I think a town hall forum where he can host it and people can give feedback and or even if he hosts it, Pence hosts it, the kids, Ivanka, you know, somebody is on there communicating with the American people and can receive feedback and respond to that. I think that that has been a hallmark of his campaign, and
is interesting because when you talk to app developers, when you talk to people who create code on the internet or create new software, if you have an open source network, you have more people that can contribute to making the software close to perfect. When you have a closed network, it may be safe, but you're limiting the talent. Trump does something genius where he says, I'm going to open this thing up. I'm going to let everyday individuals tweet and retweet me. And here's the crazy part. A lot of Trump opponents were retweeting Trump's quotes.
Doing advertising for him.
Right. Listen, name recognition, biggest barrier to entry.
I want to look at something quickly here, you guys. Let's look at Cambridge Analytica, all right? So Cambridge Analytica is a data firm that the Donald Trump campaign hires. They paid Cambridge Analytica $5 million to find the hidden votes. This is something that the Clinton campaign pretty much ignored, and they took for granted those states that went red from being blue during the Obama 2012 election. So what they did, and I'm coming to you with this, Matt Reardon, what they did at Cambridge Analytica for the Trump campaign was they micro-targeted and they took micro-populations of likely and unlikely voters who may go toward Trump. Is this going to be a trend from now on with consulting firms, with data, big data firms? Is this the changing of the game in politics, Matt Reardon?
I think where Trump was at in the campaign, he knew he had to get down to that level. He knew he had to find those people who didn't vote. I do have to laugh. It's not often I hear the word Republican and disenfranchised in the same sentence, unless it was that Republican disenfranchised voters. But what Annie said is exactly correct. There was a unit of people that had conservative views that decided, why not try this guy? So I joked around last time and I said, you know what, we're not electing the prom king. We did.
Yeah.
And he used the social media accordingly. So with all that, and it was real genius on his part and his team to continue with Twitter and everything else in the face of, hey, you know what, we don't do things that way. And he says, you know what, I'm going to do it that way because people sit in their living room and they vote for the voice and they vote for the dancer and they're used to immediate feedback. And I'm going to lay something else on you. You know what that platform also allowed? It allowed people to get out feelings.
Yeah.
And feelings are not facts. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter. And I can't convince you of your feelings are different. All I can do is say what mine are. And I gave that platform for everybody to get their feelings out there.
Yeah.
Whether you liked them or not, whether you believe their feelings or not, whether it made you uncomfortable or not, it was that platform to allow people to participate.
Kanye West quote, hate me or love me, but feel something, you know? And I think that's a very interesting point. You know, I want to go to you, Andy, on this question. Are political polls obsolete? But I want to go further with that. Should a candidate in the future, from this day forward, say, you know what, we're not even if we're down by 5 or 10 points or up by 5 or 10 points, should we totally ignore the polls? I got about 1 minute before this segment ends.
No, I don't think you should ignore the polls. I mean, polling is not obsolete. I think, these polls were not targeting the right voters. They weren't targeting the voters that were going to come out and vote, and they were not going after the voters that were not identified because maybe they hadn't voted in the last couple of cycles or whatever it may have been, or they were newly registered, and they were registered because they were on the Trump train. You know, they were there moving forward. I don't think that you should discount the polls. And polls can be wrong a lot. I think, I think Kathleen said it. Some people were, I don't want to say embarrassed, but they were afraid to say, hey, I'm voting for Donald Trump because the backlash that they might get. Mm. So they'd say, I'm not going to tell you who I'm voting for, or I'm undecided. Or maybe they even say, hey, I'm voting for your candidate. I'm voting for Hillary Clinton, but they really weren't.
Political polls versus big data, is there a ghost in the machine? Kathleen Murphy, Andy Quinnell, Matt Reardon join us at the Counterpoint. Thanks for sticking around for part two. So, we watch all of these news networks, we read newspapers, magazines, we get emails, we're watching Twitter, Facebook, Instagram feeds, people are Snapchatting. They're hearing information about what Quinnipiac said, what Real Clear Politics said, what Politico was saying, what Pew Institute is saying. Are people influenced by polls? Gerard McClendon sits at home ingesting, digesting all of this social media stuff. I see four of the most prominent political poll organizations that say vote or that the vote is going this way, plus or minus 3%. Do they influence the way a person votes?
I think so. Just the same way that getting vote results from one coast influences that in another coast. Mm. So whether you were thinking about voting for somebody and you're like, I'm not going to go do it because. Mm-hmm. And I think that does have an impact on some people that really weren't committed to voting. Or maybe they were and they're like, I'm going to do it this time, but maybe not. And then the candidate lost and I'm like, forget it. Or I'm going to go to the grocery store and change it. I think it can have an impact. I can tell you what, if I'm somebody running for office, I want to be the person up in the polls.
Yeah.
I would not want to be the person down in the polls because the old rally cry is, hey, we're down in the polls, so let's go outwork them. So you're using the psychology nonsense. But if you're talking to somebody sitting at home and they hear information about Hillary Clinton already won or Donald Trump is winning, you're like, well, I'm not going to go do it.
He doesn't need my vote or she doesn't need my vote or whatever. And, and I think that's part of the problem with the polls as well. And I think, with Hillary showing that she was up, I'm sure a lot of the Trump supporters were saying, well, wait a minute. Everybody I'm talking to is voting for Trump. How can she be up? And so it tries to I don't want to say disenfranchise them, but it almost is kind of a way of keeping them away from voting.
Yeah.
I think it impacts turnout is what I was going to say. It's turnout. If you think that it's not going to make a difference, you're less likely to go or on the
But you have
side,
to remember the down
might,
ballot races. I mean, you're not just going to vote for one person.
Very true.
Right.
So
Kathleen, why didn't Clinton concentrate on her base in the last 3 to 4 weeks? I mean, what happened, or last 2 months, really? Was it just hubris? Was it overweening pride that said, you don't need to go to Iowa. You don't need to go to Wisconsin. You don't need to go to Michigan.
I mean, if you remember what happened in those last 2 to 3 weeks, the Access Hollywood tapes came out. I mean, he plummeted with women. I think I can only speculate because I don't know, but I think partly it was, I've got this. And then, of course, James Comey drops the bomb into the race 10 days ahead, changes the whole trajectory of the race. His momentum was, you could see it. He just flip over 10 days. So I think she thought she had it, and she might as well, concentrate on locking it up in the toss-up seat.
I think too many people told her, you got this. How can you possibly lose? Yeah. It's impossible. And guess what? That's why they play the game.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's, wow. I mean, Kathleen embarrassed me during.
Now, did you have to eat your hat? Was that
the show? Oh, come on, man. What was the bet, by the way?
I want to know. I had red tie on and everything.
She retweeted all my stuff. I'm like, oh, man. But you know what?
I love the tie.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, sometimes you have to get humbled. And especially, I don't care if you're up by 10 points, when the country is shifting, especially after an 8-year stint with Barack Obama, things could possibly go the other way. And I think someone or several people in the Democratic camp, they didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they should have seen it coming, though, in the sense of enthusiasm. Her supporters were not that enthusiastic. You know, you'd see these Trump rallies with 20,000 people at it, and she'd get 1,000. And so there wasn't any enthusiasm there. That right off the bat would have kind of said to me, what can we do to increase the enthusiasm so that, because that enthusiasm is going to go back to voter turnout.
You know what's interesting about that? In Chicago, they had a continuing the Bernie Sanders movement after he was out, and I went because I think those things are really interesting, even though I'm on the other side of the aisle. And they had their sights set on the DNC because that was coming up, on Hillary Clinton. There was nothing about Republicans, nothing about Trump or any of the remaining. I mean, Democrats really were unhappy with her. They were unhappy with the results of the primary, and I think they kind of went, fine, I'll vote for her. But it was really not there. Like you said, that hurts turnout, too.
Well, to go along with that, I think they feel like the Bernie Sanders vote was stolen from them.
Absolutely.
After the WikiLeaks. Yeah.
After all the boo-hooing, Trump won.
Yeah.
He got his people to the polls. And they went out and they voted. Mm-hmm. And that's it. People arguing over, she won the popular vote. I don't care.
Well, and they all know the rules of the game before they get in.
I kind of chuckled, and the irony is perfect in that the very rules that Trump besmirched are the very rules that he has used and that the reason he is the president. Mm-hmm. I love the irony of it. It's like, you know, guy, you spent all that time bad-mouthing the system, and the system works.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Art of the deal.
The system, it's the system they all have in place and has worked for them in the past, and now he wins via that system, and now they're all mad about it.
Truthful hyperbole wins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it's the charismatic that can get you to listen to a point more so than a person that has, soundness. You know, I'm a professor. So if I come to class and just drone to students, they're gonna fall asleep, they're gonna leave class early at the break. I gotta come in there with the fire, regardless of how boring school finance might be or school law, which could be very boring. Mm-hmm. But I gotta come in there with some case studies and some news reports and some stories that are a little juicy, so it keeps them interested. So we can't count out the charismatic component. Maybe that's, I wonder, can the charismatic component be used in a poll? That might be something that will come up in 2020, possibly.
Yeah. Who'd you want to hang out with?
Yeah.
Who'd you rather hang out with?
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
Trump doesn't drink.
Right. Yeah,
who'd you rather have dinner with?
Kanye or Kim?
Yeah.
Right. I think I know the answer to that.
Yeah.
So let's look at this. Is social media now mandatory to launch and to sustain and finish a political campaign?
I think so, absolutely. It's giving the mainstream media a run for its money. I mean, in dominance and influence, it rivals mainstream media, probably is more influential than mainstream media.
Social media has done wonders for people, because if you don't like what you're getting from the network news, you could go out and find different areas, different media sources, whether it's on social media or if it's through the internet. And you have different sources now. People aren't relying on ABC, CBS, mm-hmm. NBC, and PBS too, I guess we should say. And
thank you.
And by the way, and all the and all the cable news programs, they're relying to find the news that they want to see.
Regardless of whether it's credible,
right?
Regardless of whether it's credible
or it's credible relative.
I'm back to this platform of feelings aren't facts. Yeah. And that's what this does. So I'm not going to go talk to Channel 2 News guy. I'm going to get on my Facebook page, and I'm going to go, ah! And I'm really mad, and I'm going to let it out there. I'm going to tell my friends, and I'm going to put it on Twitter, and I'm going to blow it up. And yeah. Hopefully somebody else does. And that engages a whole different kind and section of people that really, you know what, they didn't read the newspaper, and I didn't read the Wall Street Journal, and I really don't know. And boy, you know what, I know the guy can't build a wall, but he said it, and that really makes me feel weird.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
You know what? No, because he got out, and he was a salesman, and he sold it, and he did what he had to do to win. And I believe this about Trump. I believe his desire for success will amount to good times in the United States of America because of his hubris.
Wow.
Because he is that way. He does not want to be embarrassed.
Chip, well, you got a chip on your shoulder. You got something to prove.
He has proven time and time again that's his modus operandi. And I think that you're going to see that. I think you see enough people that are going to follow that. And you know what? He's their guy.
He should have kept that casino in Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, now he could have. Now we could talk about that on another show.
So you know what's interesting?
Don't get Matt started on economic
development. Yeah. So I wish I could keep you guys for two or three more shows. You know what's interesting is that the polls didn't count on 8% of the black vote going to Trump. Whoa, talk about the hidden vote. And what, 32% of the Hispanic vote going to Trump? Mm-hmm. Nobody saw that. Cambridge Analytica saw it, but nobody else really saw it. And the what, 80, 90 million that didn't vote?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's big. Give me a closing word, Andy.
Well, I think Trump identified voters. Matt and I know a guy who calls into the radio station. We're at it quite a bit. And this guy 18 months ago was... Trump's going to be the next president. He's a retired union steel worker. And I said, there's no way this is going to happen. And this guy called it. And I said at that time, if Trump wins, it's not going to be the guys, the normal Republicans that get him elected. It's going to be the guys like the manufacturing, you know, they lost their job. This guy, he's a retired steel worker, but he talks about, you know, packing up his equipment and shipping it off to China.
Skin in the game. Kathleen, did you know that this was going to happen?
You know, when I saw those exit polls call it women's intuition, I thought we're electing Donald Trump, and I wasn't always with him, as I mentioned on the show, but I at that point in the afternoon, I kind of went, I think he's in.
And I saw the look on your face.
I know, I was nervous to say it, but something said no,
man,
do it.
And this lady, Kathleen Murphy, has like, intuition. Matt Reardon, final word, man.
I didn't see that coming, but I will tell you this. I have very high expectations of my president. Right? Like I had of Barack Obama, and like I had of George Bush. And so on and so forth.
And
so
the president
now
for all
you're
the
president
people.
For all the people. So get to your job. You said you're going to take care of some business, so you better take care of it. Because you know what?
Thank you, Matt.
4 years is a short time.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore Public Television, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10. At the State House, Eric Berman tells us that LGBT activists are sounding an alarm about what they are warning is a new religious freedom bill, but the bill's authors say they're misreading the bill.
A Senate bill would block courts from ruling on questions of church doctrine, but Chris Paulson with the gay rights group Freedom Indiana charges even though the bill specifically defines religious organizations, the bills would let companies ignore local gay rights ordinances on religious grounds.
Basically, anyone who has the same religion can hold themselves out to be a, quote, religious organization, unquote. So that kind of seems like a slippery slope.
Markle Republican Travis Holdman, who authored one of the bills, says applying the proposal to businesses was, quote, the furthest thing from his mind. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
While the Indiana Senate Democrats are only 9 people in the 50-member Senate, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith tells us that one of their priorities might see some traction.
Last year, the Senate passed a hate crimes bill that allowed judges to enhance penalties for people who are motivated to commit a crime, at least in part, because of their victim's characteristics, including race, gender, or sexual orientation. Democratic Senator Greg Taylor says recent incidents, including vandalized churches, underline the need for such a bill, which he'll author this session.
So to say that we don't have them is not valid anymore. It's time to do something. It's time to recognize that people are being discriminated against based on who they are.
Last year's bill met philosophical objections, one being that the government shouldn't punish someone for what they're thinking. It died in the House. But Speaker Brian Bosma says while some objections still exist, he no longer shares them.
I voted against a hate crimes bill some years back, but the version that the Senate had, it was an enhancer under certain circumstances, I didn't have a problem with.
Other issues on the Senate Democrats' agenda include LGBT civil rights and raising the minimum wage. They acknowledge the latter won't even get a hearing. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
A group of Hoosier organizations have united to focus on a handful of health initiatives facing the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana hopes to accomplish this legislative session.
The group is made up of health and business leaders who are worried about Indiana's poor health outcomes and rankings. On a recent WFYI No Limits show, president of Indiana Hospital Association Doug Leonard says the state has serious health problems like smoking, obesity, and opioid abuse.
And some of these issues, it may take a generation of initiatives and actions to change. But if we don't draw the line in the sand someplace and start, then we'll never make a difference.
The group says reducing smoking became their first priority because it's linked to many other health problems. Indiana has one of the lowest cigarette tax rates, just short of a dollar, and the Alliance proposes hiking it to $1.50. Executive VP of Indiana State Medical Association, Julie Reed, says this is a proven way to help people quit, but
as you raise that tax, and as you drive people to stop smoking, you need to make sure you have solutions in place to help them with their addiction challenges.
Right now, Indiana only spends 8% of the CDC recommended amount on smoking cessation, and only 36 Hoosier counties have programs to help people quit. The Alliance will also work with lawmakers on a proposal to raise the smoking age to 21. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, among other topics, we're going to take up the issue of the canine flu. Yes, unfortunately, it's back here in Northwest Indiana. That's coming up tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.